everyone is a star child, made of stardust and the infinite potential of the universe. This extraordinary, fearless something in each of us clamors for freedom from the bonds of fear, conformity, and an ordinary life. Welcome to Dr. Durr's Living in the Sweet Spot, where practical tools and solutions from the intersection of mind-body medicine, science, and spiritual well-being awaken and empower you to live out your infinite potential, to live life in the sweet spot. Welcome to Dr. Durr's Living in the Sweet Spot. This is the premier show where we educate you about the essential role of brain health to create fulfillment and the greatest demonstration of your purpose and potential. My guests and I have thought-provoking and inspiring conversations that offer you practical tools and solutions from the intersection of mind-body medicine, science, and spiritual well-being to live out your infinite potential, to live life in the sweet spot. So today, I'm going to be having a conversation with Dr. Donna Perry. And Dr. Donna Perry is a board-certified obstetrician and gynecologist. She is a medical director for Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Illinois. And she has more than 30 years of experience, including 16 years of working in her own private practice in the Chicago area. Again, she has been the medical director for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois since 2016. Dr. Perry believes strongly that women's health begins with girls' health and understands the value of family and how teaching healthy habits along with the importance of preventive care can create a happier, healthy life for generations to come. So Dr. Perry is joining me today so that we can discuss the importance of doulas in helping maternal health and illness. In other words, in order to help women have better outcomes during their pregnancy and after delivery. So Dr. Perry, I'm so excited to have this conversation with you today, and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited about participating in today's program, and I want to get that information out there to the public because, you know, our community just doesn't know how important support is during pregnancy and how important postpartum care and communication with somebody who knows the warning signals when there's a problem. So I'm great to get that information out. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, you know what? As you well know, this is something that's actually really a longstanding issue for women. And initially, even though my specialty is child, adolescent, adult psychiatry, my decision to become a physician was actually because I wanted to become an OB-GYN. Now, this is when I was in junior high school, mind you. And then when I got into doing the rotations, I changed my mind and went to psychiatry instead. But the fact remains is I still love OB. So, so the risk of women having either illness or complications or actually dying from childbirth, again, it's one that's just been longstanding. And I know, you know what, interestingly enough, I think that some of the shows that we're seeing on TV, like say Game of Thrones and those kind of shows, that they really show just potentially how deadly childbirth is for women. I mean, especially back then, but again, there's this persistence. So why don't you tell us about what that looks like for women these days?
Well, I can go back a little bit in history. You know, it used to be, you know, now the women outnumber men. And this is because before the turn of the century, well, I guess before 1900, there were no antibiotics used. So after the use of antibiotics, the death rate of women decreased dramatically. So that helped in recent history. But
and overall, washing hands, right? Right.
How about washing your hands? That helps a lot, even to this day. People kind of forget. That's very important. Hand washing. But antibiotics and aseptic techniques and things like that help women survive. So even though these things have improved through the years, for some reason, the United States has lagged behind many well-developed or the wealthier countries like Germany, France, Spain, the Netherlands, places like that, as far as maternal death rates. And it's downright embarrassing how we lag. We spend so much money on health, but we lag when it comes to maternal deaths. And that's downright embarrassing. So,
Dr. Perry, let me ask you this, because of course, when you say that we lag behind and that given the amount of money that we spend, where's the disconnect? In other words, why is it that we are spending so much money but are lagging behind other, you know, industrial developed countries?
Well, you know, we're still trying to figure that out, but it seems though in other countries there's like an inverse relationship between the use of doulas and midwives and maternal outcomes. It appears though countries that utilize doulas and midwives tend to have better maternal outcomes. And we're still wondering why that is. That might be part of it. And there are other, you know, there's always other parts of a big problem, but that's one thing that we've noticed is a big difference. You know, it's like an inverse relationship. If you look at a graph between maternal deaths and another graph of the use of midwives and doulas, it's an inverse relationship. So there's something going on that end for sure.
Okay, so for those in the audience, our listening audience, who may not be familiar with a doula or maybe even the term doula, what is a doula?
A doula, that's a good question. I didn't know what one was for many years. You know, I was working, I was in the labor room one day. I was, you know, in a room with a patient and there was this, you know, young lady rubbing on her back and I'm like, you know, and talking to her, whispering in her ear and stuff. I'm like, and her husband was sitting there. I'm like, well, who was she? That's your sister, your cousin? Who was this woman who's all, you know, all in your business like that? And she said, that's my doula. And I didn't want to seem ignorant. I'm like, what's that? You know, I didn't even know what it was. I mean, honestly, and this was years and years ago, but still, I mean, people don't know unless you actually see one or have an interaction with one or have a family friend or somebody interacts with you wouldn't know. But a doula is a non-medical support person. In other words, they're not doctors, they're not nurses, but they're a person, somebody who has focused their education on maternal health and well-being. And they provide supportive services before, during, and after pregnancy, and during delivery particularly. I mean, they provide a lot of support. They focus a lot on breathing techniques and focus your mind on other things other than your pain. And, you know, watching, it's pretty amazing how effective these people are with laboring patients.
So let me say this in terms of acknowledging to your point, you said you learned about doulas several years ago. And frankly, I think I only heard of doulas maybe about a year or so ago. And that's actually because, frankly, a friend of mine, and also she's my hairstylist, is actually also a doula. So,
okay, good for her.
Yeah. And so, you know, she did her training and, you know, as she was going through her education and she was talking to me about it, you know, she's now, completed her trainings and certified. So I'm thinking again, and I'm a physician and just kind of recently hearing about doulas. So how about we do this? Specifically, give some specific examples of what a doula does. I know you said you talked about kind of the rubbing and the massaging, but also helping them with breathing, helping them manage their labor and their pain. What are some other kind of specific things that they would do prior to labor and then also postpartum?
Okay, what they do, they focus education on education. So it depends on when a mother opts to have a doula. She may have a doula just for delivery. Mm-hmm. She may opt to have a doula before she gets pregnant, so she knows what to expect. So all along pregnancy, they will, you know, let a mother know, okay, you know, depending on the stage she is, okay, you should expect this during pregnancy. Now, you know, me as a doctor, I can tell her certain things, but you know, we're like on a timeline. We have loads of patients in our waiting rooms, and we have, you know, X amount of time. And you know, I spend a fair amount of time with my patients, but I still have a limited amount of time to go over every detail. So the doula's education is more detailed and more customized to a person's needs. So it depends on, she may want her for right early pregnancy. She might want her for delivery, like I mentioned. She may want her in the second trimester. So it all depends on at what point the mother feels she needs assistance. Now, they found to be particularly useful in delivery, of course, and postpartum. Postpartum, doulas can alert a mom when there's a complication, if she's having problems with breathing or pains or breastfeeding. A doula can assist with that. And doulas are particularly helpful when there are late complications of pregnancy, like a blood clot to the lung. There are certain symptoms that may persist. And if a woman has somebody she can just talk to on a regular basis, those negative outcomes can be averted. Sometimes people are not as quick to call the doctor because, well, I don't want to bother her. She's busy, or I'll be okay, or, you know, things like that.
Or they don't recognize they're in trouble.
Exactly.
They don't recognize that there's a problem, and they don't recognize that problem has progressed and they're in deep doo-doo.
Yep.
And in need of immediate attention and
a doula's right there. A doula's right there to say, girl, I think you might need to call your doctor. Well, I'm going to call your doctor for you, or the nurse practitioner, whoever, you know, call somebody for help. A doula will help a mother recognize that there is a problem going on, because they are educated in recognizing these problems and getting the proper help for their patients.
So now let me do this in terms of, one, I'm kind of going to go backwards actually to when they're in labor. One of the things that in my researching doulas, they talked about the fact about, because of course, with the change in care in terms of how it's provided, that the nurses during labor used to be present a great deal of time in order to offer support to the laboring patient. But of course, now that has changed, and so that support is not there the way it used to be. And so therefore the doula's presence, again, offers the mom, the laboring mom, support through the process that she no longer has actually from the hospital staff.
Well, I think that varies between hospitals. There's been staffing issues in recent years because of the nursing shortage, and that might be the case. But, you know, every hospital is different. Just overall, even when there were more nurses around pre-COVID, things like that, the doula was present before they got into the labor room. And it's somebody that the patient knows and always feels comfortable with. The nurse, she's just going to meet her. She doesn't really know her. That bond isn't really there. I mean, bonds are developed, very rapidly, because, you know, it's like you need help. It's like, oh, Becky, you gotta go home. You know, so there are, you know, you know your people right away. But the doula is somebody who's a constant in their pregnant lives, and I think they provide support in a different way. I don't want to take anything from our nurses, because the nurses provide a different type of support. And again, they do have other patients, but the thing about doulas, there's already a relationship present when they come in late. So I think that's a big difference.
Agreed. And of course, so let me say this, one of the one of my most favorite people in the whole wide world is a nurse. And so I love nurses. So I would never in any way suggest or, you know, that the nurses are not providing the level or quality of care that they should. What I'm really just talking about, of course, is like all things, medicine has evolved and or changed.
Yes.
Some of it for the better, you know, just when we talked about some of those basic things, you know, using sanitary procedures and processes, antibiotics, some other things. But there's also some things where I think how medicine has changed is challenged the way we provide care and the connection to the patient, right? And yes. When you have the fact of the matter is, especially with the demands of COVID, the pandemic and how it's affected things, the numbers of nurses, the stress upon nurses and all staff for that matter. So it's, and medicine is more medically focused even before we got right to the pandemic. So I think the ways that some of the ways that nurses are able to provide care has been changed. So again, having that person, in this case, a doula there to help support you, to help kind of calm you, to ease your fears, to interact with staff on your behalf, to get questions answered, to get maybe certain kinds of care or treatment. And while, as you already mentioned, doulas cannot make medical recommendations, right, about decision making, you know, however, their approach, I think, is also more patient and sometimes
supportive.
Yes. Yes. And so here's the other thing too, you know, you and I've had the conversation previously where we talked about, you know, intervening, in terms of the delivery process. And I don't know if you think that, and this, I think, would probably be an opportunity for us to kind of segue into the issue of, you know, maternal health and mortality, i.e., you know, illness and death, because the fact of the matter is the research shows, and even our experiences show, that amongst African-American women or women of color, that we experience that at a far higher level or rate than Caucasian women. And it doesn't matter how much money you make, right? They've had this,
as Beyonce.
Right. That's what I'm saying. We've had two instances fairly recently where, you know, Beyonce, who's pregnant with twins, you know, almost died. And she either had preeclampsia or eclampsia, but I think it had evolved maybe into eclampsia. And then, of course, you know, Serena Williams, who almost died from a blood clot. So again, it goes beyond socioeconomic status.
Yes.
So why don't you address that for us?
Okay. Again, the maternal mortality in the United States far outpaces other wealthy countries. And it's for, well, I think all women, but particularly women of color.
Mm-hmm.
Women of color, particularly Black women, are 3 to 4 times more likely to die having a child than a white woman. And, you know, they wonder, well, why is this happening? You know, even if you cover the social economics, like you said, it doesn't matter how much money you make, how much education you make, you still have this problem. It's like, well, why is that? And I mean, honestly, when my daughter had her baby last, well, I guess almost 2 years ago, in 2021, mm-hmm. I was petrified because I couldn't be there because it was still COVID restrictions.
Okay.
And my daughter is educated and she's married and well-versed on prenatal care, the whole bit because of me, of course, but I couldn't be there. I couldn't be there to protect her.
Right.
And that was, I was mortified. Anyway, that's another, I tell you, that was a great story. But the reason why this is because it's thought to be from implicit bias. And what I mean from implicit bias is that it's things in your mind, in the back of your mind, that you don't even know are there. So it might be, Black women always complaining, or, you know, she's not paying into the system, or, you know, Black women, they don't really need pain medicines. They can tolerate more pain than white women or other women, you know. You know, it's just things that may be in their minds that they don't even know are there. They're in their subconscious, and therefore they might not offer pain medications as often, or they might not check on them as often, or, you know, they get different treatment.
So, overall. And then let's just, you know, just also add in the implicit balance. Well, let me just say it like this. Also, there's a bias that, some folks believe that we're not human beings, right?
That's
that,
right.
That therefore, again, we don't experience pain in the same way.
Exactly right.
That they do. That we don't therefore, as you already mentioned, need pain meds. We don't need or deserve the quality of care and treatment that a Caucasian woman they feel is entitled to. So those stereotypes and really unfortunate beliefs lead to higher rates of death and illness for us, I think, across the board. And, you know, I think we're way past the point of where we need to, you know, where we really need to, as a society, we need to evolve, right? We way past the point where, as a society, we need to evolve beyond those beliefs that if you're not white, then you're not a human being, right? That you're subhuman.
That has to change.
Correct. Correct. So to go back to what you were saying in general, just about implicit bias and how that impedes access to care. You were saying.
Well, I'm just saying implicit bias sometimes is a problem because it's like women of color oftentimes don't have the voice when they say, I have a problem. I don't feel anything. I don't feel my feet, or I can't breathe. Those complaints are not heard. And the result is sometimes fatal, because if somebody's telling you something's wrong and you don't hear it, you don't act on it, then that means they may get treatment later, or ineffective treatment, because if it was taken care of earlier, it could have been more effective.
Right. So here's the other thing too, that happens. And one, just in general, women's complaints about being ill in general is dismissed.
Absolutely.
Again, you know, because we're also dealing with a profession that's largely patriarchal.
Yes. Right?
So just in general, regardless of what color you are or your socioeconomic status as a woman, your concerns, your complaints about not feeling well are subject to be attributed to it's all in your head.
Dismissed. They're dismissed. Same thing with heart attacks in women. Women die more of heart attacks because a lot of times their symptoms are not the usual symptoms that men have.
Correct.
And when they have complaints, they go unchecked. Mm-hmm. And by the time they come back, if they can get back, they're either near death or dead. So again, you're right. Women are, their complaints are dismissed. You would think that in an area where it's all about women in an OB suite, you would think that all women should be listened to equally, but that's not the case.
So let me just ask this obvious question, which is, do you know at this point about what the proportion of men to women, what the ratio is of men to women who are OB-GYNs? Any ideas?
Oh, women far, well, women are the majority now. In 2012, women outnumbered men by 51%. And so right now it's even more so.
Okay. All right. So the other thing too, that I was going to, I always think of too, and is an example of this, of women's, you know, complaints being ignored about their health and not feeling well, is Gilda Radner. So we, you know, this was, of course, was many years ago. You know, Gilda was famous, right? Yes. Well known for her skits on Saturday Night Live, you know, Rosanna Dana. And Gilda ended up dying of ovarian cancer. And she had been seeking care, seeking treatment for an extended period of time. And her complaints were always dismissed. And so ovarian cancer, and you can talk about this, ovarian cancer is usually takes a long time to be diagnosed. And so by the time they found it, diagnosed it, of course, it was terminal. So just again, using that as an example of how women's care, we don't always get the care that we need or deserve. Just using that as an example, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts on ovarian cancer are a little different because ovarian cancer is very elusive.
Okay.
It's a very elusive cancer. Sometimes you have no signs or symptoms at all. Or it might just be, oh, my stomach kind of hurts. Mm-hmm. Very vague symptoms a lot, unless it's suspected. I can't remember her age, but I think she was kind of young. Usually ovarian cancer comes a little later in life. I'm not so sure. I don't remember her. I didn't read her chart, so I don't know all the details about her case. But I can say that ovarian cancer is very difficult to diagnose unless it's suspected. You know, you may have a family history of ovarian or uterine cancer that might make it make you more suspicious, but it depends on the symptoms. The symptoms are very vague, belly aches, gas, constipation. It can be different and very difficult to find. So I'm not really sure. Again, who she talked to, what symptoms she reported, but I can speak to the fact that ovarian cancer is difficult to diagnose overall.
Yeah, so she was 42 when she passed. Yeah, she was young.
Yes.
Yeah, she was definitely young. So let me ask you this then. So where does this leave us, you know, at this point, when it comes to, you know, women getting care and care that is appropriate, that's life-saving, frankly, when you as a woman are, you know, and again, we were starting talking off about, you know, doing pregnancy and mm-hmm. you know, postpartum. And I think part of the thing too, that is an important part of the conversation is, you know, how women getting, you know, care while they're pregnant, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that, because that's still an important part of improving the outcomes of the delivery.
Well, it all depends on where they live. You know, there's different reasons why people don't get care. Mm-hmm. And it's not just women of color. It depends on where you live. Rural women, you know, are often overlooked, and the more Caucasian women to live in rural areas than mm-hmm. Black women, even though a lot of women of color do live in rural areas, they're even worse off. But geographical locations to getting care is a big problem. And they're called healthcare deserts. But one out of three healthcare deserts actually are in urban areas. So they're not always in rural areas. So access to care, just being able to get somewhere, is a big problem. And it's a problem that we're working on right now.
So when you say access to care, kind of elaborate on that. Are we talking about located?
Yes, that's one.
Talking about people in terms of their finances and transportation.
Exactly.
We're talking about the fact that they have, if they have younger children and having, you know, childcare,
yes,
so that they can go to appointments. Let's talk about that some.
Yes, all those are related to access to care. You know, where it's located. Do they have insurance? And insurance, I want to get back to the postpartum care. Okay. Insurance has been a problem in the past. Why so many women have died is because they didn't have access to care. Traditionally, we're going to talk about Illinois. I know about Illinois because I've lived in Illinois, practiced in Illinois. Women have gotten postpartum care up to 60 days. It has recently been extended to, you know, full 12 months instead of 2 months, 12 months, because there's things that happen later on postpartum that need to be addressed that many women could not could not take care of because they did not have any insurance. They didn't have any way to get to a doctor. And if they got to a doctor, they had no money to pay for it. So Illinois is one of the states that has actually extended their postpartum care to 12 months. And I think that the people of Illinois need to be commended for that change, a big change. So that was another problem. Women did not have access, don't have access to get prenatal care or postpartum care. And now that has been extended. So getting to the doctor, having insurance, having transportation.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry, let me just ask you for clarification. So when you say that Illinois has extended that, are we talking about Illinois Medicaid? What are we talking about?
Yes, Illinois Medicaid. Yes.
Okay.
Illinois Medicaid has extended their coverage for, I'm sorry, I should have clarified, I'm sorry, has extended their coverage for their Medicaid population for 12 months, which I think is commendable.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic, actually. So what do you think should or could be done in order to improve access to care, you know, during pregnancy?
Well, we have to develop more programs. First of all, we have to expand Medicaid, and we're doing that in Illinois, and some other states are doing it as well, but not enough. Expand programs to assist women in getting services, getting them to a provider. We have to increase our providers because, unfortunately, the OBGYN population is diminished. I mean, so we have
So hold on for a second. And, you know, let's talk about that because this did not just happen. Remember, and of course, I've been practicing for over 20 years, right? So you're talking about, and looks like I kind of lost you a little bit in terms of, there we go. Yeah. The, even when I was in residency, the cost of malpractice insurance was astronomical and a deterrent for some folks in terms of their decision making to go into OB/GYN.
Yes. It is. It's ridiculous. And you know, that's the elephant in the room. You know, nobody talks about liability, malpractice. You know, can you find a provider? Most OB providers are located in urban areas because, you know, you might have somebody who, I have a friend that, well, one of my residents who practices out in Ottawa. I don't know if he's still practicing or not, but he practices by himself. Nobody wants to live out there. You know, they want to be in a city where they can get backup.
So you mean providers don't want to live out there?
Yeah. OB/GYN doctors.
Okay.
We don't want to live out there. I like going to Bulls games and I like going to plays and going on these nice restaurants. I love my lifestyle. And I live in the city.
And don't forget shopping, right?
We won't even miss that.
Yeah, I like it. Great food, great shopping, great entertainment, right?
I'm guilty. I'm one of those.
Yes.
You know, I like it, and most people do. And so the rural areas are kind of left hanging. They don't have enough providers. So, and then it's, you know, our malpractice is out of control. In Illinois, some states have controlled it in other ways, but it's a problem for providers. So there's a provider shortage. And
so, you know, so to give a concrete number, how much are we talking about? How much is liability insurance for?
You know, I don't know. I don't do that anymore. I got out the business a while ago, but I can tell you what it was when I was practicing out in back in 2000, whenever that was, 2016, it was over $150,000 a year just to work.
Right. And so here's the other thing too, again, that I remember when, again, I'm in medical, in, you know, medical school, and, you know, so we were talking about the 90s, the early to mid 90s. And I remember times having conversations, you know, with family or friends. And I said, do you have any idea how much liability insurance costs? And they were like, no. And so back then I was like, it's $120,000 a year. I said, that's before you turn a light on, right? Mm-hmm. Before you've rented, you know, office space, before you've paid staff, before you paid yourself, before you've done anything.
That's right.
Right? Before you bought equipment, before you've done anything, you already, you know, in debt for obligated to $120,000 in order to work.
Just to work.
So, and the folks that I talked to, of course, had no idea that there was that kind of expense involved. I said, so when you all are concerned about the cost of healthcare, one of the reasons why it's so costly is because of the liability insurance. And then, of course, when you add into, again, the various reasons why women may not get care during pregnancy, you add in things like, you know, and just being honest about it, substance abuse. Oh, my gosh.
A big problem.
Yeah. Let's talk about that.
We can talk about that. I'm glad that you brought that up because, you know, mental health is a big problem in postpartum. People don't realize the amount of postpartum depression and substance use and postpartum. In fact, 4 out of 5 pregnancy-related deaths in the U.S. Are preventable. And a lot of that prevention comes from the mental health side of postpartum care. You know, women of color don't seem to be, they don't get screened at the same rates. And if they do get screened, the follow-up is shoddy. You know, there's no solid follow-up. And if there is follow-up, okay, what do they really do? I had a patient, and she wasn't even a woman of color. She's a Caucasian woman who reached out to me. She felt she was going to hurt her baby and herself. And I sent her to a facility that, you know, said that they were specialized in that. They saw her in the emergency room and then they sent her home. And then I got a call from her husband that the baby was being airlifted to Indianapolis because she was from Indiana. And I never got any follow up behind that because I kind of didn't even want to know because I knew what happened. He said he rolled over on the baby, but we know that's not what happened. So it's all about getting healthcare and the mental health care in the right time and having proper follow-up and who they're going to follow. So we need to develop more programs to follow our all our women, not just women of color, all our women during this time is very, very high risk time for women. And substance use disorders, actually many of these postpartum deaths are related to postpartum depression and substance use.
So when we talk about substance use in this case, what kind of substances are we talking about?
Use these opioid disorder. Those seem to be the problem.
Okay. You know, and so are we talking about in terms of maternal death? Are we talking about infant death? We're talking about both. What are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about maternal deaths right now. And, you know, more than, you know, half of all pregnancy related deaths happen, you know, after that 6 weeks, that 6 week checkup. So we need to watch our women. We need to have more mental health programs available for them. And hopefully we will bring this out in this conversation and let people, you know, education is key.
So, you know, so one of the things when you say education is key, for me, mm-hmm. I think one of the basic fundamental understanding that's missing in general with medicine is, and this is where I try to say it to people, your body can't live without a brain.
You need a brain. Well, most right. of us do.
Right. You know, whether you believe that you're a human being or whether you believe that you're a spiritual being, you need hands and feet in order to live out your infinite potential, to demonstrate your inherent wonderfulness, right? And in order to have those hands and feet working, you need a brain to operate them. So I think kind of basic fundamental truth seems to be missing from our conceptualization of how we provide care. And what I mean by that is, it doesn't matter if you're an OB-GYN, you know, or if you're in family practice or peds, or if you're in surgery or oncology, it doesn't matter what the medical specialty is that you are practicing, that you're dealing with a person who has a brain that has to run everything except some basic simple reflexes. And so if that brain is not working properly, guess what that means? That means either you're going to have glitches in how you think, what you think, how you feel, what you do, how your brain functions and operates. And so then when you look at also that basic truth, to me, doesn't seem to be a basic fundamental tenet or inclusion of how we treat patients, how we care for patients, that then we're not looking at what does the brain need in order to be healthy. You know, for me, I look at and tell people, in order to have a good or great product, you have to have two things. You have to have quality raw materials, and you have to have quality workmanship. And if not either one of those are missing, you start to get an average or substandard product.
Right.
Specifically, in this case, I'm talking about your brain. So it's right. So one of the things that we don't do well because it's not part of our training is nutrition, right? Nutrition, the nutrients, vitamins, minerals, proteins, amino acids, all of that stuff that our brain needs to function with, blood flow that our brain needs to function well, that's an important part of the conversation that's missing even in primary care. You know, vitamin D, as you well know, vitamin D is hugely important. Mm-hmm. And 70% of people that live north of Atlanta, that level drops off by the time you hit to March, which of course is peak time for the flu. But it also, it's 70% of people, since they live north of Atlanta, are deficient. Number one, vitamin D does a number of things. It's important to have a strong immune system, right? So when we're talking about COVID or any other viruses or anything else, any other invaders, mm-hmm. including cancer cells, the yes. vitamin D is important. But vitamin D is also important in things like chronic pain, depression, anxiety, right? So all the things like magnesium, selenium, chromium, zinc, iron, B12, folate, all of those are critically important in your brain health in preventing depression and anxiety. So those are, so when we start talking about even in terms of maternal health postpartum, to me, that's an important element, that's an essential element, brain health, that's missing from our care.
You're right. Yeah. You're right, doctor. And I'm glad you brought that up, because in the Black community in particular, it seems there's stigma associated with mental when you have mental health issues or you want to get mental health. And I think the stigma is what keeps a lot of people from seeking mental health, even if they feel like they may need help, the stigma associated with it. So we need to work on that in our communities and get it out there. Just like you said, if your head is not right, nothing's right. Just like you mentioned, okay, we're talking about mothers. If mama's not right, nobody's right. So if mama's not right, she's not getting the proper mental health, this is going to affect her baby. And this will affect the next generation and the next generation. So it's super important that we get mental health going on in the Black community in general, but particularly for our mothers, because we need to get these babies off to a good start. And good babies need good mamas.
Absolutely. And so here's the thing. And we kind of talk about that with regard to some things, but we know, for instance, like they'll talk about, make sure you take calcium because the baby is pulling and will pull that from your bones as the mother, if you're not getting enough calcium. But the same thing is true with the rest of vitamins and minerals. And so we see these instances of postpartum depression, which of course can be an indicator that the mom actually may have bipolar affective disorder. Postpartum depression is a risk factor for having bipolar affective disorder. And so then that needs to be assessed. But also, again, the baby is pulling these nutrients from the mom. And so if she's not getting an adequate supply of these minerals, again, that can also cause a drop off in depression. Also, to your point about the quality of mothering, how are you going to mother well if you're depressed, right? And you know what I will share with people is, again, I've had bouts of depression off and on, and I remember since high school. But I remember after having my son, who is now 17, I remember basically what I was doing, and my husband was went on active duty like 7 months after he was born. So I had really little or no support either. And I was basically kind of keeping the wheels on the cart, right? I was taking care of him. Make sure he was loved, make sure he was fed and changed and nurtured and that kind of thing. And I was going to work, but there were a lot of other things that, you know, and other things that are important to do in terms of my adult responsibilities that I couldn't necessarily get to, you know. So it's, and the studies are out there. So let me just say this too. The studies are out there and have been out there. When you have like, I'm talking about like more than 20 years ago, that there, you know, they did this study where you had it was a monkey basically. And so how did the monkey develop based upon the interaction it got with some kind of mom figure? So first there was no mother figure. Then there was a wire figure. Then there was a wire figure, you know, wrapped in some kind of soft cloth. And basically what they found was the less of the figure it had. So it went from the wired figure with the soft cloth down to the one with nothing. The more aberrant was the behavior of the monkey by the time they got to no mother figure. Because of course there's no nurturing, right? Mm-hmm. There's no guidance. There's no comforting. There's no nothing there. So the development of that, you know, child monkey, the smaller monkey,
it's a baby monkey.
It's just aberrant. It's abnormal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I said that again to support your point that, you know, we have to have healthy moms and we have to have healthy parents in order to have children developing in a healthy way.
Right.
It's just like, you know, common sense. Although one of my attendings, he was the chief of radiology at the Westside VA then, Dr. Espinoza, and he would say, common sense, the least common of all senses.
Right.
You know, this ain't rocket science, right? That we should be able to know and understand these things.
So, being a mother is overwhelming anyway. I mean, being a mother myself, and, you know, I had support. Even if you have support, it's overwhelming. You know, all of a sudden, you're somebody's mama. I remember getting up, you know, my first daughter, I got up, I was going to go to the store. I said, I needed some toilet paper or something I needed. I just got up and was like, get ready. I put my hand on the, I'm like, I can't go anywhere. I got a baby. I have to get her dressed. I have to feed her. And I decided not to go, but it's a whole, but it's a whole adjustment of who you are. You go from a regular person to somebody's mother. That whole concept is overwhelming. And depending on where you are with your nutrients and your baseline mental health, it can send you over one way or the other. You know, do you have a mother? Do you have a sister? Do you have friends? Do you have a husband or a partner that will, you know, give you a break? Some people don't get a break, you know, and everybody talks about the first month, the first baby. I think we need to put more emphasis on the second and third babies, because the first baby, you can go lay down if you're tired. The second baby, you got somebody that needs to be fed and needs to be, you know, taken care of. You can't lay down. And so we need to address maternal health, I think, maybe in a different way, you know, going forward, to make sure all women get what they need.
And I was going to say, and to your point, it was actually a study that was on marriage that came out recently. And the name of the study escapes me. But again, it was a study of marriage. But one of the things they looked at again was how having children and childcare, you know, impacted the marriage. And so one of the things that they discovered was, on average, it took about 33 hours a week to take care of an infant and to take care of a child. And I was like, oh my God. I said, see, this is the kind of information, that kind of concrete, specific information mm-hmm. that we need to get out there, because there are a lot of jobs, 30 hours a week is full time.
Yeah.
With benefits. You know what I'm saying? So if you, now you got basically another full-time job on top of taking care of you, on top of, you know, if you are a working parent, and then, so you potentially now have what, especially if you're a single three full-time jobs. How are you supposed to do that and then not end up stressed, not end up necessarily depressed or anxious? And frankly, then I can see while it's not right for a child to be abused, it's never right. It's never okay. But I can see how that can easily happen in that circumstances, yes. In those instances where you have three full-time jobs and little or no support. And then, of course, there's always the other elephant in the room, is that because of the more traditional ways that roles and responsibilities are broken out, that, you know, how much mm-hmm. is your partner, even if you are married or even if you are living together, if you have a significant other, how much are they actually participating, you know, in the care of this child? So, you know, I just, you know, again, wanted to kind of take it back to what you were saying again about, then again, problems with depression and problems with anxiety. And then, of course, also, you know, also substance abuse, right? So whether that is opiates, whether including pain pills, including heroin, including benzos, you know, so we're talking about prescribed medicines, benzos, marijuana, of course, now, of course, and marijuana is legal, but it still doesn't, you know, it still doesn't mean that it can't be overused.
It's like alcohol.
Right. And I said, some people, even some of my patients goes, it's not a drug. So I didn't think I needed to mention it when you asked me about drugs. And I'm going, is alcohol legal?
Right.
Yes. Alcohol is legal. It's still a drug. So being legal is not a determinant if something is a drug or not. And certainly not if it's, you know, if it's overused. So for me as a psychiatrist, to me, it's far more about, we need to make programs available. We need to have, and I'm going to say this, how do we have health programs in schools and don't talk about brain health? Are you serious? How do we,
stigma. It's stigma.
But we're stigmatizing the very thing that we need. It's like, and I'm going to use something simple. It's like stigmatizing soap. You know, I want to use body wash, but I don't want to use bar soap. You know what? You need some soap. Right. You need some soap. So there's this whole disconnect of what really matters. We need a brain. Like I said, your body can't live without a brain. We need a brain to operate our bodies. So what we're stigmatizing, the very thing that we need in order to live, in order to do anything, in order to dream, in order to fulfill purpose. And we've made it about who we are, what it says about me, you know, that person's weak or they're inadequate and obviously it's, you know, the whole thing about people are crazy. And I tell people there's a difference between what I call cray cray, which is dysfunctional behavior, versus mentally ill. The brain is an organ just like your heart, your liver, your lungs, your kidney, and it can become ill just like any other organ or tissue in your body. So why don't we treat it that way as opposed to making it personal in terms of it's some character issue or it says something about the person. Now, clearly what happens is it can show up in your behavior, right? In that you know, and I think really what it comes down to is people are afraid that they're going to end up being the person who's pushing the shopping cart or the bag lady, you know, down the street, homeless and talking to themselves and acting strange or weird. And so if something's going on with me, and then what if they tell me that? Or what if I have to take the medicine? Sometimes I was somebody making medicine and I think the side effects are worse, you know, worse than the medication itself and worse than the benefits, you know, just, you know, and a lot of folks sometimes don't agree with the diagnosis. So I think there are all of those issues, but again, to bring that back around to, you know, mental health and maternal health and morbidity, I think it needs to be a fundamental part of the care that we provide on all levels, and certainly even primary care, whether it's family practice, you know, whether it's OB/GYN, whether it's whatever, internal medicine, especially because those are usually the doorways, the entry, in terms of, so I think medicine itself also needs to evolve. So just what are your thoughts about that in terms of its incorporation for better, you know, maternal outcomes?
I think you're right on point. In fact, when I was in private practice, I spent more time doing your job than my OB/GYN job. You know, people needed to talk. They needed to talk things out. And, you know, people complained about the weight. When they got to me, they just poured it all out, you know, and I assisted them. You know, they just need somebody to talk to that they felt safe to talk to. I was a safe space for them. But unfortunately, times have changed. And, you know, OB/GYNs are in short supply. We have to get people in and out. So we don't have that time. So we're going to have to try to incorporate mental health in our prenatal programs. Some kind of way. Now, you know, we're talking all this, there's limited funds, there's limited time, but, you know, we have to make time for mental health. And I think we haven't in years. And I think now we're seeing the end result. I think 30 years ago or something like that, they closed down a lot of the mental health facilities, at least in Illinois. And now we're having a lot of problems and they're wondering why things are the way they are. And I think a lot of reason why they are the way they are is because of what we've been doing with mental health, which is ignoring it. And I think we need to incorporate it definitely in our prenatal programs some kind of way.
Well, you know, the other thing too I say to people is think of your brain like air traffic control. So when air traffic control goes down, and we just had something recently within the last few weeks where then you had more than 3,500 planes that were grounded, right?
Right.
At other planes that had to be diverted, you know, heaven forbid. And this didn't happen with this most recent occurrence. But again, I'm talking about, think about it. If air traffic control is not working, you potentially got planes circling and potentially running out of gas, or they got to make emergency movements. You got planes crashing into each other. You got, again, planes that are grounded, can't get off the air, can't get out, they're grounded, cannot get into the air. And we really need to think about our brain in very practical terms, such as those, which is in that, therefore, it's essential. Brain health is essential in our abilities to live, to function, to have relationships, again, to fulfill dreams and purposes, to care for our children and enable for them to be well-developed, nurtured, loved, and to be their, and to be their best selves. So, you know, again, to bring this back to what we started off talking about is while doulas, again, are not, they're not medical professionals, that I think sense of support and well-being, even in the prenatal period that, that they offer, clearly while we don't necessarily know the reasons why, but we know even just supportive therapy, and we know that placebos, which is the belief that this is going to help me, has a significant impact upon how well people do, right? So having somebody to listen to you, having somebody to help you formulate opinions and formulate solutions and have better outcomes. Would you agree?
Well, sort of. I mean, that's part of it, you know, in the long term, the long run, but during labor and delivery.
Let me say, we're going to have to go ahead and wrap up. I know we are loving this conversation.
Well, I'm looking at time. But I'm just going to say real quick that in labor and delivery, they provide more focused care for them and allow them not to, there are less interventions. And when they say interventions, we mean C-sections and operative deliveries like forceps, things like that. And so there's less blood loss, less chance for repeat C-sections, and more, the morbidity, mortality that comes along with that. So I'll just stop right there.
Yeah. So it sounds like that you would highly recommend including doulas in the prenatal care during the pregnancy and postpartum. Am I hearing that right, Dr. Perry?
If possible, somebody who has more time to spend and answer questions, focused questions, because a lot of times OB-GYNs are not available and don't have the time that they would like to share with patients. Times have changed. So doulas will be a welcome addition to the prenatal program.
So, you know what, we're going to push the pause button, and I'm sure that there will be another opportunity for us to continue this really important conversation. And I want to say thank you so much, Dr. Donna Perry, the medical director of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois, for joining me today and having this conversation and, you know, imparting your wisdom and your knowledge and your experience to myself and to my listeners. And so with that, I will say that I am Dr. Balan A. Durr, awakening and empowering you to live out your infinite potential, to live life in the sweet spot. And I want to make sure that you stay tuned, that you like us, follow us, share on social media. And again, stay tuned for these thought-provoking, sometimes mind-blowing conversations that awaken and empower you to live in a sweet spot. I'll see you next time. Thank you for joining us today in the sweet spot. Share, follow, and like us on social media. To learn more, please visit BalinADurrMD.com, spelled BalinADurrMD.com. Join us next week, and remember, when you heal your mind, all things are possible.